Hello everyone, and a very warm welcome back to Footprints. It's December, it's nearly midwinter, it's cold, it's dark, it's wintry. So where better to spend this episode than in some cosy Bath community-owned pubs? Now, the last few years have not been a good time for pubs, what with the pandemic, rising energy costs and, of course, inflation. More than 500 closed their doors in 2023, but community pubs, it seems, are thriving. Now, although this isn't a particularly new thing, the first one was the Red Lion in Preston in Hertfordshire in the early 80s. As of January 2024, there were upwards of 180 community-owned pubs in the UK, and Bath has three of them. So in this episode, we're going to take you on a pub crawl. We'll visit The Bell in Walcott Street, which was the very first in Bath. The Packhorse Inn in South Stoke was the second to open, but let's start at the Hop Pole Inn in Limpley Stoke. It was bought by the community, and after 3 years of frantic fundraising and back-breaking work, it's set to open its doors at the end of January for the first time in 9 years. I went there on a day when it was snowing and met up with the man in charge, Simon Coombe, and asked him why the pub was so important to the village.
I think a village without a pub is just a collection of houses, and Limpley Stoke being 5 miles outside Bath, if it didn't have a hub where people come together and they talk and they can gossip and learn about each other and learn about what's going on, then people start getting very isolated and very lonely. And certainly that was the feeling that we got talking to people in this village when the pub closed. I think it last served a pint about 8 or 9 years ago now.
Oh, quite a long time. So all through COVID years?
All through the COVID years it was closed. It was closed when the owners said they were trying to find a seller, and eventually when it transpired that there was no one who was going to take over the pub as a going entity, they told us they'd found a buyer who was going to turn it into a residential home.
So we're going to go and have a look around it in a moment, but just tell me a little bit about its history and what it's seen.
Yeah, we've learned a lot about the history as we've been going through this project. We've had archaeologists, we've had historians, we've had people digging up in the grounds to learn more about the past. We've had people in the community who have gone through the records right back to the start to find out really what this building has meant for the community for so long. And we have clear evidence that this pub went back to at least 500 years. In fact, back at the time of the Reformation. I don't know if you're watching Wolf Hall at the moment, but I was pointing out to my wife last night, what you're seeing now is when the Hop Pole was first started. It goes back a long time. And at that time, or just before Henry VIII took over the throne, this building was owned by the Priory over in Hinton Charter House, where the monks, and this is something which Thomas Cromwell was not so impressed with, had various monopolies of he would describe as corrupt, one of which was a monopoly over selling wine and beer. And this building used to be part of Hinton Priory until Henry VIII started chopping heads off wives and grabbing the church back for his own use. This building has changed a lot. In those days, it was probably more like a wine house. It probably sold ale. In fact, back to the 19th century, I don't know if you know the difference between an ale house, a tavern and an inn.
Do you know, I really don't.
So an inn is a pub where people can stay in. Because this valley, the Limpley Stoke Valley, was a time of massive activity back in the 19th century. It was a valley down which the Black Dog Turnpike, which is going right in front of us as we speak, it looks like a small narrow lane, that was originally the Black Dog Turnpike that linked Bath to Salisbury, going through Warminster. There's a section still called the Black Dog Hill today. So this was a thoroughfare for travellers, for merchants, for members of the clergy, going between the cathedrals. And then in the early 19th century, the canal was built, linking Bristol all the way through to London, came straight down this valley. This was a particularly tricky bit of the valley, which is why we've got two aqueducts, both at Dundas and Avoncliffe, down this particular stretch. So in the early 19th century, there had been an awful lot of people involved in the building of that canal. They needed somewhere to stay. And then, of course, in the later 19th century, the railway was built. And the railway station is almost opposite the Hop Pole. which sadly the railway station closed in the beaching cuts, but this railway line is still a very active railway line, and as we speak a train is going past, absolutely on cue. So a very entrepreneurial publican realised that there was money to be made by heavy accommodation, so he built the accommodation at the top right-hand part of the building, and you can see standing here how the building has changed over time by looking at the stone, by looking at the mortaring, etc. So that's why it's an inn, but the difference between an alehouse and a tavern is that an alehouse is where the working person would go for a pint of beer and a good natter after work, whilst the gentry, who would rather have a glass of wine and possibly something to go with it, would go to a tavern. And again, the entrepreneurial tenant of the owner of the hot pot at the time decided he wanted to capture all businesses. So if we stand right where we are, you can see there's two doors into the hot pole. The left-hand door was created in the 1850s because the owner wanted to capture the business of the gentry as well as the working person. And so the right-hand bar was the alehouse, and the left-hand door took us through into the tavern.
So tell me, are you going to have that division now?
That's one of the many changes we're making to the reopened hot pole. So this is all about a building that's changed over time. The ground floor of the building was back in the 1500s, when the building was known as a hall house. And a hall house is where the owner would have lived on the left-hand side, and the right-hand side would have been where the wine and the ale would have been kept. But all the features of a hall house, in terms of the fireplace, the doors that go straight through the building, the single-storey thatched, is absolutely what this hot pole used to originated at, somewhere between 1500 and 1550. And then standing here, you can see the different parts of the building, how they've added up over the time. The top left, the stone, you can see cut stone. That's from Limpistoke Mine. That was put in place around the 1780s. And the top right, that was when the hot pole turned into an inn and they added the accommodation. But if you look at the next transformation that we've been doing over the last couple of years, if you look at the stone of the chimneys, the cut stone of the chimneys, that has come again from the mine in Limpistoke, which still operates today, only a few hundred metres from where we stand. And the owners of the mine very kindly donated the stone because they realised this was right at the heart of their business when it started. They've donated the stone to help the hot pole reopen in all its glory.
Beautiful colour in the valley, isn't it? Against the autumnal trees in the background. It's really lovely. It's a lovely building.
It's a stunning building, and there is so much of this building we've learned as we've gone through the restoration.
Now, the name, Hot Pole, why is it called the Hot Pole? Is it just because beer is made from hops?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Beer is made from hops. The hops would have grown in the area, and if anyone has ever grown a hop plant, you'll know they're very, very long, straggly plants. And therefore, if you're growing hops, you have very long poles, which are all linked together, and the hops dangle down from the poles, which is how you harvest the hops. So a hop pole is probably a good 20 feet long. There are, in fact, only 9 hop pole pubs in the country, 2 of which are in Bath, which implies that this area, going back a few hundred years, was probably hops were probably a very significant crop of the area. They are no longer. They're known for Kent.
Anybody famous come by this way over the last 5 centuries?
But of course, what would you expect? Probably the most famous that most people have heard of was a guy who's currently standing on the top of Trafalgar Square. So Lord Nelson, one of his best friends, one of his captains, one of the captains of Trafalgar, was called Penruddock. And he lived in a house only, we can see it from here, only about 50 metres away. And Nelson was known to come down and visit his friend, Captain Penruddock. And even more salaciously, Nelson, although married at the time, many people know he had quite an attractive girlfriend called Lady Hamilton, and she was known to come down here as well. And we like to think they may have shared a glass or two of Madeira at the Hot Pole. We have no hard evidence of that, but we love the idea of Lord Nelson having been here.
Right, should we go and have a look inside?
Let's go inside. There might be some
because there's a lot of activity.
Hammering and banging because we're getting close to the reopening, but let's go inside and see what we can see.
So I'm walking across the entranceway, which is a building site. And actually today, the first day, it's actually snowing. But it's warm and toasty in here.
It is warm and toasty. And this is the barrel room, which has always been the place where the wine and the beer were kept. And this is come back here in a few weeks' time, and this will have the barrels of the local beer, because we will be stocking all the finest ales and cider that are produced locally. So we're now in the main bar area, and you'll see there is a new ceiling of fresh oak. The reason why we've had to put a new ceiling in is when we purchased the pub 3 years ago, we realised when the main beam that was over the main bar didn't actually meet at the end. It was about 6 inches short at the end and was held together by a very strange cantilever structure. And as soon as our engineer, surveyor, looked at that, he told us we had a serious problem on our hands. And we realised that this was the bar where the village always used to come together on a Friday night. It was packed from almost everyone in the village. And had that beam broken at some time on a Friday night, the vast majority of Limpley Stoke would have been taken out.
You could have wiped them all out. But look, they're sitting on a beam that's 4 or 5 times the size and length, and that looks original. Is that original?
That is original. That's an original elm beam. We've had it dated by... You can't carbon date elm, I've been told. But it's been dated by the technique of using as to the way it was cut. And that, although it wasn't in the original place, that beam goes back over 500 years.
It's absolutely stunning, isn't it? I love that.
And the plastering here has been another challenge. So part of the issue has been taking an old building, Grade 2 listed building, and part of our challenge has been making it work for the 21st century. And that means that we have to have accessibility. We want anybody else to come to this pub. So we've had to take out 500 tons of earth to make sure we're level on one site. Another challenge has been making this energy efficient, because we want this to be a green pub, green in terms of minimising its carbon footprint, but also making sure that the tenants, when they join, can make a viable business concern of having their energy costs as low as possible, because the more thriving they can make the business, the better it will be for the community. And one of the things that we were looking at the plastering of the internal walls, we had to use a plaster that breathed alongside that stone I was telling you about, but also had strong insulation qualities. And when we took down the wall we're facing at the moment next to the main fireplace, we took down some panelling, and behind it we found the wall was black, thickly coated with soot. And we realised that before the fireplace that we're standing in front of was built, they just had a fire against the wall to keep the place warm. And because the soot was caked so heavily into the walls, we couldn't take the soot off. And if you put plaster over soot, it actually leaches through. But we were very lucky at the time. We had a Somali gentleman who was he says he's the only black historic plasterer in the country. Somali refugee from 19 years ago. He came to this country 19 years ago, used the techniques of plastering that he'd learnt back in Somalia in his village. He used the hot pole as a training ground. He said, look, I'm a refugee, I've made a future in this country, and I want to help other refugees make a future. And the hot pole was the perfect venue for him to bring his apprentices, all of whom were refugees, one of whom, Ahmed, was telling me he'd walked across 10 national borders to get to this country. And what I found really interesting was when we came across this thick soot and we weren't too sure what to do with it, Dahir came up with the answer. He said, all you have to do, and this is a technique he'd used back in Somalia 20 years ago, you need to mix the plaster with a local product. And do you know what that local product is? Cow poo. And so we went out to the local farmer, brought it in a few buckets, mixed it in with the plaster. And so the first layer of plaster had cow poo mixed in. And as you can see now, no leaching has taken place. But it's fascinating. We're using a technique in a 500-year-old pub that has been going on for centuries in other parts of the world. And I found that a lovely revelation in how techniques are universal around the world and across time zones. And I think what's lovely about this building that we've created, it's taken the best of the old and mixed it with the best of the new. And I think if anyone comes and has a drink here and looks around, they'll see that everything is very much in keeping or looks together. But it's an incredible mix of the very ancient technologies with the very latest technologies.
Well, I think this pub's going to be absolutely fabulous when you open it. I can't wait to come and have a drink here and maybe a meal. Will you have food?
We are going to have fantastic food. Our new tenant who's taking over the pub, there's two of them, they're a young couple, and the chef is trained at Gavroche. He's worked amongst the best, and he was brought up just a mile from here at the top of the hill in Winsley, where his dad is still a beef farmer. So he'll be able to source all his beef, both locally and within the family, and he's already built some raised beds in the garden so he can grow his own herbs and vegetables. And his whole concept is going to be field to fork, and his food is going to be worth travelling a long way to come and enjoy.
So tell me how you managed to raise the money, because you've obviously spent quite a bit on refurbishing this.
Well, the money has come from so many different people. We have raised in total £1.2 million for this project.
Wow.
Initially, when the building was put on the market and we were told it was going to be sold to a property developer who's going to turn it into housing, a small group of us got together and said to the community, do you want us to stop it? And they said yes. And we were given 6 weeks to raise the £360,000 we needed to buy it. But with 3 days to spare, we raised the money and bought the pub. But it was quite a daunting task we then faced, because we then had another £900,000 we had to raise. And we've done that through issuing shares to a large number of people. We've got over 800 investors. So the average investment is about £1,000, not only in the village, not only in the nearby villages, but we've got investors from all over the world. But on top of that, we've had over 150 people come and volunteer here. And an awful lot of the work you see that's taking place right now around us is all done by volunteers. We've got volunteer plasterers, volunteer electricians, volunteer consultants, volunteer gardeners. People who've got skills, bring their skills. People who haven't got skills, just lend a hand. And that itself has saved us hundreds of thousands of pounds. And then on top of that, we've had donations. And whilst we always felt that the reopened hot pole was the main goal in terms of bringing people together and enhancing that sense of community, what we had appreciated was the journey itself of people coming together, offering whatever they've got, has been part of bringing the community together even before the doors open. And that's been the most pleasurable, most heartwarming aspect of this entire project.
And when do you open, Simon?
We have a planned opening date of the 25th of January, 2025, I hasten to add.
Did you choose that date on purpose, 25th of the first 25?
That was completely fortuitous. In fact, I hadn't even thought about that. That was very clever of you to think that.
Thanks there to Simon Coombe. And as Simon said, the Hot Pole opens its doors on January the 25th, and you can find all their details in the show notes. Let's head into the centre of the city now to one of Bath's most well-known music pubs, the Bell Inn in Walcott Street. And at the back of the garden of the pub, it also houses the office of the famous Bath Fringe Festival. And it was in there that I found Steve Henwood and Wendy Matthews. Here it is. This is where it's happening. It's all very bright and gorgeous. Loads of posters everywhere. And, well, look at that above me. There's a lot of banners hanging down. But we're at the back of the Bell, and we've come to the Bell because the Bell Inn is the first community-owned pub in Bath. Is that right, Steve?
Absolutely it is, yes. And we like to think we set a relatively good example for some other businesses that have gone into community ownership since.
So tell me a little bit about how that happened.
Well, the guy who owned the Bell at that point, a fellow called Ian Wood, he's still around, nice guy, had decided he'd had enough of running a pub, really, or had enough of owning a pub. So he announced that it was going to be for sale.
That was in 2013, around this sort of time of year, wasn't it? I think it was in November. And everybody went, oh my God, what are we going to do? And panicking a bit and thinking, oh, it's going to be dreadful. It's going to be owned by some pub core or whatever. Steve said, no, we can buy it. Let's buy it as a community pub.
So, Steve, you were the driving force. You were the one who said, we're going to have to buy this.
Well, I'd seen that buying your own pub was a thing that people were doing. And we called a meeting to see if anybody else thought so, and remarkably quite a lot of people did quite quickly, you know.
I was going to say the background really is that this is quite a special pub. Walcott is a special area anyway. It's always been quite alternative and different. The pub is one of the few more community-oriented bohemian-type pubs left even 10 years ago. And I think a lot of people were very, very concerned that if somebody else took it on, that they'd want to change. Well, we were fairly certain they'd want to change it in some way. We knew that if it was a co-op, then we would be able to have a lot more control over keeping it the way it was.
So when you say the way it was and Walcott, tell me a little bit about the area and what you were striving to keep hold of.
Well, one of mine and Steve's main reasons was that we had the Fringe office here, and we wanted to make sure that we carried on having. So it was self-interest, really.
Steve, what's special about this pub? What's unique about it? Why did you want to save it? Why did you want it to be a co-op?
Well, it's the community around it. I mean, any decent pub has its own community. The Bell has several communities. The one I'm most connected to is the musical one. Is the bands who play and the people who follow them. I mean, music is a very sociable thing. It doesn't easily get divided up into boxes and slots and things. And the Bell had a great history as a jazz pub in the 70s under Bradshaw, and that was quite a lot of the same people coming round again in a different guise in a different band. That's an identifiable music community around jazz. But as we'd been doing it in the meantime, we'd built up comparable scenes around folk music, jazz, funk, other things like that. A music venue is a community, and the Bell was and is doing that quite well.
You know a lot about music then.
I was a local music journalist for the late lamented Venue magazine. I play a bit myself, so...
I guess your background in music journalism you've brought here to the Fringe and also to the Bell Inn, and that's what's made it unique.
Yeah, I mean, I got excited by artists and groups that I saw in other places and thought, well, we could. I know a bunch of people that would like them. Let's bring that along, and that's where the Bell's programming comes from, and it comes out. And then other people who know the people who came first, they suggest, you could try the Bell, and some of those work out, and that's how it goes.
One of the things that makes this pub unique is the music, but also the community. Tell me about the community that live in and around here.
Walcott Street has got a long history of, is where the Natural Theatre Company started and the Bath Arts Workshop started down the road, ran lots of festivals, not just in Walcott, but Walcott was the hub for that through the 70s. And we've carried on with that with the Fringe through the since early 90s. And I think it's not really necessarily even people that actually live around here. The people come from all over. Shareholders, people who bought shares in the pub, are not just local. They're people who used to live here. And we have got shareholders who live in other parts of the world as well, who, if they happen to be in Bath, will come and visit. So it's a Walcott state of mind, isn't it, as much as anything else. And we're still clinging on to that alternative thing that Bath used to have a lot more of, say, certainly in the 70s.
You were the first, and tell me about how you managed to raise the money, Wendy.
Yeah, well, the asking price was £925,000, which we balked at, of course, and we were going to try and raise as much money as the target was £575,000, and then we were going to get a bank loan. So we had 5 weeks to raise this money.
You didn't have long then,
no,
did you?
No. And week one to four, the progress was quite steady, and it felt really good, but we knew we weren't going to get there. And then in the fourth week, we managed to get some of the big hitters like the Stranglers and Michael Eavis and Robert Plant and the Darkness. And in sort of supporting it, they didn't all put money in, but that engendered a lot of publicity as well, and we got publicity in some very strange publications all over the place, didn't we? And
those are big hitters, aren't they?
Yeah. So I don't think they've all played here, but they may be of all.
Have the Stranglers played here, Steve?
Not officially. Most of the current lineup, which is not the classic lineup, have been part of things, but no, the Stranglers haven't played as a group. No,
not yet. Who else bought shares?
Michael Eavis, Goldfrapp, Robert Plant, The Darkness. Well, I don't know if they all bought shares, but they all expressed interest. And, yeah.
It is true. It was a relative novelty at that point, and we got good national press coverage the moment that we started getting some names involved. Then there was something to write about, and the ball rolled that way. And we did have, I mean, a couple of our volunteers or people that worked here were working quite hard at getting the. I suppose it's almost a prelude to using influencers, you know. It was getting some names interested that we could then talk about to get more. That worked quite well. I mean, I'm not sure it would work as a tactic anymore, but it was useful to us at the time.
What else happens here, Wendy?
OK, so encouraging new talent as well as the more... experienced bands that play on in the pub. We have a thing called a playgroup on a Thursday, which is an open mic session for budding musicians and some people who like playing open mic spots to encourage new talent, really.
It's a really important thing, isn't it, to have spaces where people can just come and play and get used to being in front of an audience rather than in their bedroom or back room or something.
Yeah, and one of the problems with Bath I've seen this over many years, is there have been fewer and fewer places where people can do that. And they're closing down. There used to be lots of back rooms or upstairs at pubs where people could put gigs on or put plays on or whatever. The Grapes is a new one, newish one. So it's nice that there are some new ones springing up. But the Bell's consistently been... the hub for that after the Hat and Feather, which was the seminal pub on Walcott Street that we didn't manage to buy, unfortunately.
Did you try?
No. We weren't offered the chance, I don't think.
Well, let's go and see the pub itself. Leave this nice, warm, cosy fringe room where I can sort of see 2025 coming into view, which is exciting. So we're coming in the back way now.
Steve Edward.
So, the new wood burner, that's quite recent, make this little area a little bit cosier. And then we've got a nice fire down that end as well. So it's a relatively cosy pub.
It's a very warm, cosy pub, yeah. Isn't it? Low ceilings. It feels like it's been here forever.
It has. How old is the pub? 350 years, is it?
Something like that.
Yeah, I can't remember. There used to be markets on Walcott Street, so it was open like from 6 o'clock in the morning on a Wednesday, apparently, in the old days.
Well, why not? Let's just walk around then, shall we? Yeah. Just have a look.
When we first, the first few years that we took over the pub, behind you there is a pillar, and that used to be, the strut was all the way up to the ceiling, which meant if you were trying to watch the band and you were standing behind that in the room, you didn't get a really good view. And we decided it'd be quite nice to actually put that in. And there was such an outcry about people saying, you can't get rid of that. You can't, it'll destroy the pub. And, of course, it's much better and nobody cares really anymore. But you do have to go through those sort of things with people,
People don't like change, do they?
No, and I think one of the things we've had to contend with is everybody's idea of what the Bell is or was is completely different. So when we say we want to keep the Bell the same, everybody's view of that is completely different. So you get in the consensus of what that actually means and what the essence of the pub is sort of quite difficult, but I think we've managed it quite well over the last 10 years.
You've used this pub for many years. You worked hard to get it bought, and now it's a cooperative in the community. Has that changed it at all?
In some ways it has, because when it was owned by one person, he was quite mercurially and he had his own ideas about what could and couldn't happen. And so in a way, it was his view, or it wasn't necessarily any less creative, and he was quite active in allowing people to be creative if he agreed with what they were doing. Whereas now, even though it is a cooperative, there's more of a sort of, has to be a consensual view about what will happen, and I think in a way that might stifle the creativity a little bit.
My angle on that is, what we did when we bought it was that we set it free a bit. It doesn't owe anyone any money, doesn't owe any bank any money. It's its own thing, and we have to let it go a bit, and it has to, collectively the staff and the customers have to decide how they want to steer it, it's got another 100 years or so in it, if not two, and we don't know where it's going to go, but it's going to be under its own power rather than an overseer or a bank.
When we first started, we did have quite a number of people who said, it'll never work unless you let me put in my £100,000 towards it, because we were one member, one share. No matter how much money you put in, you've gone and got one vote. And I think some people were thinking that they needed to be more, you'd need the elite putting more money in to make it work. We did make it work, and it's remained profitable, and we've got 692 members now because we've had a further share issue. So yeah, it's really successful, and I think that's testament to the co-op model and the pub as well, really.
Thanks so much to Steve and Wendy for telling me about the Bell. And now finally to the Packhorse Inn, which reopened its doors in 2018. Perched on the side of a steep hill overlooking the beautiful Midford Valley, the Packhorse Inn has been the centre of South Stoke life since the early 17th century. We start outside the front door where Don Morehouse, the managing director, is showing me the date of the pub. Oh, there's the date.
Yeah, it's actually 1674 on the stone there. But when we got the dating done, it was with the timbers up in the roof. And what is it called? The dendrochronology, isn't it? When you date the timbers. And it was that analysis which took it to 1618. And I think it's apparently quite a specific dating.
So 55 years older than the door date.
Yes, that's the understanding.
Well, let's go back inside into the warm. See what else we can find.
This board here we're looking at is all of the 430 shareholders that so generously leaned in and made it possible. We were chipping back a load of plaster actually from this room here. And what was previously here was a very sort of nondescript, kind of 1950s little fireplace. So as we were chipping back the plaster, one of the guys said, "Hey, hang on, there seems to be something behind this." And it was essentially a Victorian fireplace. Firstly, you just thought, why would anybody have covered that up to put this kind of modern monstrosity in front of it? We carried on working. About 20, 30 minutes later, the same guys were like, "Hang on, there's something outside this." And that's this fireplace here that you can see now, which is an original sort of 17th century stone fireplace. So what we then did is we put a message out on our social media at the time, and we had a pretty active Facebook page, essentially said, "Look, this is what we've revealed, but it's going to take a master stonemason to repair it. Perchance, is there any master stonemason out there that can help?" And we got a message back straight away, a guy called Nigel. Nigel essentially came back to say words to the effect of, "I've been following this story. I absolutely love it. I am a master stonemason. This has got my name all over it." And he was living in France at the time, but he tripped back with his wife in his van, lived in the car park for a week in his van, and essentially fixed it for free. And I tell that story because he is one of hundreds of kind of tradesmen, tradespeople, companies, local businesses that gave their sort of time, labour, services for free during that period, and we often say it was built by 1,000 hands, and Nigel and his wife were two very important hands within that.
That's brilliant. It's a beautiful fireplace. It's criminal that anyone wanted to cover it up twice. Now, I heard tell that there might be a secret door to one side or the other of it, possibly leading to a priest hole. Is that correct?
That's the other side of the pub. So if we were to go over to the tap room, which is, you know, probably the most atmospheric, historic room in the pub, and you can see the Inglenook fireplace there. Yes, reputedly the priesty tunnel was off of there. So. Now, this is steeped in kind of local myth and lore, but there was a chap who, Brian Perkins, who's a fantastic friend of the pub, who's in his 90s now, and Brian was born in the pub, so his father was the landlord back when he was a young boy.
Wow.
And Brian, actually, when you get him to chat on the topic, can remember being a young boy when they were doing works in the basement, and it sort of revealed a tunnel that then got covered up again for the works that were going on at the time. But Brian certainly is 10-year-old sort of, you know, boy memory is that, you know, there definitely is a tunnel and it's reputedly connected to that Inglenook. So, yeah.
And where does the tunnel lead, Dom?
Well, you can see that if you look out the window, Pommy, so the beautiful village church we have behind us, 100 metres or so.
So we think the church had a secret tunnel coming straight to the tap room.
Well, that's the myth. And we actually got some surveying done when we were, you know, doing the buyback, is to 1618. And it's linked originally as an alehouse, as it's connected, you know, to the village church. So, yeah.
It's the most beautiful part of the world, isn't it? You're perched right on the side of the Midford Valley, looking down, you know, sort of at the back of Bath, but looking down towards Midford. I think what we should do is have a little look round. We're going to walk away from that roaring fire, but we'll have a look round and we'll see what you've done to the pub, because, as you say, it was derelict for a few years, but it's been here for centuries.
Absolutely, yeah. Actually, and on the timing front, coincidentally, when we did eventually reopen it, it was exactly 400 years to the date of the dating of the pub.
Where should we go?
If you want to have a look upstairs.
Should we go and have a look upstairs? Come on then. This is a spiral wooden staircase. All the old stone windows are here. In front of the window are loads and loads of board games. It's definitely a community pub, isn't it?
Honestly, Pommy, there are times, you know, I mean, what I would also say to people who are trying to do similar is... God, there's a lot of work involved, yeah. And I think if any of the team that had been involved in the initial bit, if we realised how much work, you know, maybe we would have thought twice. But that said, you know, you have some moments here and you just, you know, you look around at what's happening and you just think, even if it's just for tonight or today, it was worth the effort. And I was in here actually a couple of weeks ago, and, you know, Tuesday evening, and there was like a male choir in this room here, you know, singing along. There's a book club in another room over here. There's people playing some of the games in the other room. You know, fires are going. Just like, how lucky are we to have this on our doorstep, you know, quintessential English village, you know, pub.
Is it haunted?
Coincidentally, you are stood in the place that is apparently the hotspot of the hauntings, which is this little bit of passage here. So,
well, I only thought about that when I looked down that corridor.
You've got the
I looked down there and thought...
The sixth sense, Bobby.
That looks haunted.
No, but James, as I say, and actually maybe we should grab him. He tells a lot of stories about, you know, noise,
yes,
and sort of movements
that
around this.
Where
part of
James?
The corridor.
James, you're the general manager. I just looked down this corridor and thought, the question came into my head, is it haunted? And Dom here tells me that bit there that we're looking at might well be.
Yeah, very much so. This is the hotspot for the Park Horse ghost.
Tell me more.
A couple of instances of ours have been voices, flashing lights. I've had things come off the top floor and come right down to the bottom when there's been no one else in the building.
What do you mean, things?
Boxes, flip charts. That kind of
flip
stuff,
charts
so.
have come down the stairs.
Yeah, yeah. And also two separate people, completely unprompted, have told us that, you know, they found things. Where we're stood here now, they felt the same feelings. So,
have you seen anything yourself?
Nothing yet, but we're not alone.
Not alone. So are we allowed to, can we go up the stairs where the flip charts came down?
Yeah, I can show you where they were came from.
Can we see? Oh, here we are. They're quite ancient, aren't they? A whole flip chart came down these steps.
Yeah, all the way down. All boxed in, came right down. So.
Oh my gosh. Well, it has got a feeling about it, hasn't it? It's ancient wood, I suppose. That's the difference. I feel a bit cold. Let's get downstairs. Thank you so much, Dom. This is a beautiful, beautiful pub. It's got a lovely atmosphere. You've done amazing work getting it back up together and getting the community involved.
Well, absolute pleasure. And yeah, people are intrigued. You know, as always, we're a very welcoming establishment. So please come and visit. Check it out.
Thanks so much to Dom Morehouse there and Simon at the Hop Hole and Steve and Wendy at the Bell Inn. Well, that's it for this episode of Footprints. Thank you for joining me. Links to all the items in the episode are in the show notes as usual. Don't forget you can listen to all the previous episodes anytime you like. And please share as widely as you can with friends, family and colleagues. For more information on Bathscape, visit the website bathscape.co.uk. Thanks too to the National Lottery Heritage Fund and players of the National Lottery for supporting our work. Footprints was hosted and produced by me, Pommy Harmer. We'll be back in January with a review of 2024. And so from all of us at Bathscape, we wish you a very happy new year.